accession number 12368. This is reel 4.
Mr. Clark, reel 4.
On that particular day, we ran into General Patton, whom I found a very able, likeable and witty man. He explained to us why we had not completely encircled the Germans. He said in his rather flamboyant style, so when you get rats in a trap, you don't put them in a sack and close the neck, leaving them to break out anywhere, you know not where, but you leave the neck open and bash them on the head as they escape, which is pretty well what, in fact, happened at Saint-Lô. To have done otherwise, as some people have asked, would have mixed up the British, the Canadian, and the American armies inextricably, so you would have had them on different lines of advance. We were racing as hard as we could go for the bridges over the Seine and at Mont Gassicot. In fact, we our particular line of advance was to Chartres, where we got into the town. A German was still sniping from the cathedral steeple. Here it was we met the German FFE, the so-called...
French
FFE. Yes, French FFE, the so-called French resistance. As Patton also said rather vividly, their contribution was more than expected, but less than advertised. At Chartres, we waited a little while because the Germans lingered rather longer and we had extended our forces quite a bit. But we proceeded further to Rambouillet, just a motor drive, as it were, down the road. And here we were, our advance was stopped while we waited for the French 2nd Division under Leclerc, General Leclerc, to come up. It had been decided that the French were to liberate Paris. But we were getting people in Rambouillet who had cycled out of Paris and gave us reports of the Germans evacuating it as fast as they could. Next day we went into Paris with the French division. They tried to impede us a bit, we went in via the Quai d'Orléans, the southern end. There was sniping going on, a good deal of sniping, but people were jostling and kissing us and giving us drinks as we rolled along. There weren't, of course, any British in Paris at that time, and I, in British uniform, had was particularly mobbed. We pushed on into Paris, where we had great difficulty in getting to our rendezvous, which some wag having decided we were to stay at the Hotel Scribe. Scribes were to stay at the Scribe. I remember a Welsh girl there who, seeing me in British uniform, said, "Ah, a Tommy, you see," and said, "May I kiss you?" Which, of course, I allowed her to do. But of course, the Scribe was without any provisions, and we still had to eat off our army rations. But we got a room there. One little amusing instance was a colleague of mine, Paul Boucher, who had been in Paris when the Germans were approaching it in 1940, had left his laundry there and his bill. And when he arrived at the screen this time, he was handed both over the counter.
He was recognised.
Yes, well, he knew. He was known of old as dear old Paul. Rejoicing all night long in Paris, of course. Next day, came along with de Gaulle. De Gaulle had a huge welcome on the Champs-Élysées. Later on that day, in walking around the streets of Paris, it was astonishing. You'd come to a corner and find a milling crowd around some particular chap who'd been a collaborator, being hit and bashed about with wood and everything else, cowering, probably a tradesman. In fact, you would now and again hear shots, and they were dealt with summarily that way. That afternoon, we got a Belgian dentist and his wife, seen us walking on the street, beckoned us up to their flat, where we were given champagne, and invited to join them in their a penthouse that they had in the Crillon Hotel on the top floor there. So we went along to this party. The whole of the Concorde below us was completely covered in by the crowd. In it you see now and again the crowds of first aid workers, all in little posses with a white flag, a rallying ground, and the Leclerc's armour drawn up in front of the Crillon. We were drinking away there happily with all the other people at their parties when shooting began. It began from the roof of the Crillon, where, as we found out later, the milice, that's to say the Danon, the French Vichy collaborators, had opened fire on the crowds below to try and cause disruption and perhaps presumably get some assistance from whatever Germans were still in Paris. As this fighting broke out, I happened to be on the balustrade there, and some of the shots were undoubtedly aimed at me. My battle dress was covered in little chips of stone from the stonework, and below, the tanks of Leclerc were turned up, their guns were turned up to fire up at the water tower from which the Vichy machine gun was firing. There was an awful lot of panic in the place. I was there, I suppose, pinned down for a good 10 minutes, a quarter an hour. As it happened, as I was to find out later, all this was being described on the BBC radio back at home, and my own wife was listening to it in this particular corner of Paris. When the fighting stopped, I went down and was asked by the management to lead 5 FFE men with rifles to try and winkle out this machine gun post on the water tower. And we had a wonderful time going from room to room, trying to find these people in case they were hiding in rooms behind curtains, and sticking these to lovely paneled, sticking their bayonets into lovely paneled wood. Eventually we got to the roof, where we found a very petrified French hotel porter lying on his stomach, his green baize apron, I remember. And it was at the water tower. It was absolutely petrified and unable to move. It was the the machine gun had been rested on his tummy while they fired.
Who had been firing?
The milice, you see, the Vichy people, so on. That was the day, of course, when they also opened fire on de Gaulle in the Notre Dame, you know. So, anyway, we didn't... clearly, among them was a crowd milling about as they were. The milice had got away. Well, Paris after that was... You know, we tried to regain some of it. I think we had dinner at Maxime's one night, which was a pretty good meal they put on for us. But you'd go into a bar and you'd find furtive people... on one occasion, I found what I thought were Germans already in disguise, and we tried to set a trap for them, but they escaped before we could bring in the American military police. One I remember, I was beside him, and he'd clearly got a revolver in his pocket, so I wasn't going to take him on. There were an awful lot, as in fact the British flyers had lived in Paris right through the German occupation, for that matter. It was easy enough for Germans to get into civvy clothes and to presumably fake their identity cards or what. We thought that, we have a wonderful life being able to live at the Scribe and go to the front each day, come back, write our dispatches and have a bit of a whirl in the evening, you see. But in fact, this didn't occur because the advance went so rapidly that, believe it or not, on September the 3rd, the anniversary of the outbreak of war, I was actually in Germany. We liberated, we set fire to a German village there. I was with an American armoured cavalry patrol.
Was this on the Saarland?
No, Moselle, really. I forgot the name of the village now. But of course, the advance had gone so rapid that it was we were unable to maintain the advance, and we had to withdraw back quite a bit. In fact, Nancy became the winter headquarters of the Third Army. There's a little incident on one of these days soon after the capture of Paris, in which we joined an American armored column, and we're going round the bluff of a hill, when ahead of us was an engine, it's a steam engine, in a station. There were the Germans in this train. You could see them hanging out of the window. We put a shell through the engine, and then there was what I could only describe as a rather short, sharp cowboys and Indians battle. The Germans soon surrendered. They were escaping from Paris and thinking that we were miles away, but in fact we were right upon them. And this had been done with the connivance of the station master at this little halt. He was with the FFV had delayed them. But the train was full of not only the Germans, but their flusies as well, escaping from Paris, their girlfriends, and full of champagne and drink and silks and cloths and things of that sort. It was a real... real devastation when we got inside the trains. We were there through this rather wet, harsh winter until the Bastogne, what's the place called? The Ardennes. The Germans started their Ardennes attack in just before Christmas 1944, we had taken quite two of our armoured divisions out of the line to rest them during this rather impossible weather. It was colder than I ever remember anywhere. And so that when the Germans attacked, although Monty had made a big claim of having sorted the situation out, it was really correct, as Eisenhower said, that we had taken a calculated risk by leaving our front only thinly manned at that time. Because, of course, all we had to do was to set our two tank divisions along the northern road to hit the German flank, and they couldn't proceed any further. Bastogne took a little time to liberate, where the German, the American 82nd Division were surrounded. But it wasn't by any means the really dangerous operation that history has suggested it was. After that, the march, when the weather eased up, the progress went on more or less as on a scale of an occupying occupation operation. We went in via the Eifel country of Germany. We crossed the Rhine at just south of Mainz, at a place called Offenbach. In fact, it was the last time I saw a German plane. As we were crossing the pontoon bridge there, the three Messerschmitts came out of the sky rather low, machine gunners without any effect. That was on, as I remember, March the 13th, because it was my wife's birthday. And we went on to Mainz. There was some bitter fighting for Frankfurt, where we had to run the gauntlet over a bridge. And after that, we progressed up to the Erfurt Gap. Very little fighting. There was one occasion there where we were going along the road in style when somebody suddenly saw there was a German staff car in our midst. This was a German general who was completely oblivious to the fact that he had joined an American column prisoner. I had a long talk with him afterwards. He spoke very good English. Yes, he was rather astonished. See, so easily done in those days. And we went on, and in fact, before long, we were east of Berlin, and could see the factories, chimneys of Leipzig. But by that time, the question of occupation zones between armies was being put into effect, and we were diverted south through Schleswig-Holstein. Saxe-Coburg, that's right. And on into Czechoslovakia through the Bohemian Wood. It was this time that we were coming upon the German concentration camps. In fact, I was among one of the first to enter the very first concentration camp, or rather, extermination camp, in the little village of Ohrdruf. It was completely accidental that we came across it. We were pushing on through through a glade of the Thuringer Wald, and saw this rustic arch on the netting, and outside it a long pit with a railway lines across it. And we went into this through this arch, and there lying before us was 70 of the inmates. They had all got little enamel bowls, which they had apparently been called to for for them. What, what's the word?
An appel?
An appel for their meal, yes. Yes, appel, that's right. Oh, dear. And then they'd all been shot through the, with the connectors, shot through the neck. Among them was an American airman, because we discovered this from the tag around his neck. On a gibbet beside this little parade ground, wooden gibbet, was hung up by wire, were three naked corpses with the chloride of lime sprinkled over them. And in the pit were the remains of hundreds of other corpses. This was their idea of cremation. The logs underneath, burning away underneath the, in the pit, and the rails across the top, you see. And after that, I went into Buchenwald. And
what was the name of this place?
Ohrdruf, O-H-R-D-R-U-F.
H?
O-H-R-D-R-U-F. It was a very simple little village. It was impossible for the villagers not to have known of its existence or what was happening, because they could walk by the place if they wished. It was completely open.
And you described it as an extermination.
Yes, well, it must have been what it was. What the difference was very little anyway between concentration camp and extermination camp.
Any sign of people in charge?
No, they're gone.
And no, how many were alive then?
None. No.
You found nobody alive?
Not at all, no. And the villagers all pleaded ignorance of it. In fact, the mayor, that night, the mayor of the town and his family all committed suicide. He hanged himself on the on a curtain rope.
How did you find this out?
Well, I think we were told about it. I didn't see it, but it happened. The next, about 2 days later, no, I think possibly a week later, we were in Buchenwald, where again, I don't know. These were scenes that my thoughts...
How did Buchenwald compare with Ohrdruf?
Well, it was a different kind of camp. It was much... Ohrdruf, of course, was a satellite camp of Buchenwald. Buchenwald was a big camp. I don't know how many thousands of people were in it. As we walked into the place, I remember seeing these poor, bedraggled people. One particular sight was of seeing one man who was no trouser bottoms, pajama trouser bottoms. He was clearly a severe dysentery case. He was squittering as he walked, and he was being led along to the latrine by another man who was in not much better state. It just struck me that this was man's humanity to man anyway, even in the midst of all this. And in the hut there, the first hut we went into, there were these like battery hens lying on there under one blanket on wooden boards. There was a young boy of about six who was presented to us in a clean and condition. He had apparently been smuggled in there somehow and kept alive by the others. It was there that I handled we went along to the hospital, so-called hospital. It was really a path lab, in which all these experiments tattooed skins and the making of lampshades by Ilse Koch and others. There were three so-called doctors in this path lab who showed with some pride what they had been able to do. They told us about their experiments. They had been completely corrupted by their life. They were inmates themselves, and they produced this pygmy's head in which the simulated what the Indians do in South America. And I held this in my hand, actually. And there was the ovens there. Was corpses still in the place. The next day, I mean, to show how unbelievable the place was, Parliament, not the next day, 4 or 5 days later, the Parliament, thinking that our reports were exaggerated, sent a commissioner, 5 people out. I remember there was a Mrs. Mavis Tate, who was an MP, and a chap named Hind, I think. What they saw just took their breath away. And Mrs. Tate, in fact, went home to England and committed suicide herself because she felt somehow responsible for these things. And of course, there's a big operation put into effect which, by the Red Cross, which saved the lives of enormous numbers of these people. That was a sort of duplicated in a dozen other smaller camps that I came across between Buchenwald and the Bohemian part of Czechoslovakia.
Were any of those extermination camps like Ordrov?
No, I think Ordrov was the only extermination camp I found. But again, I mean, it still took its toll of people. I remember in one at a place called Ebenwald, we got quite a welcome from the inmates there, and we gave them our K rations, which was apparently the wrong thing to do, you know, it was full of glucose. And they gobbled this stuff up. And we actually saw one chap regurgitating what he had eaten, the K rations. And we saw another man eat that vomit. That is the state to which they had been reduced. They were almost animals themselves. In that particular place, Ebenwald, they were helping to excavate an underground hangar for planes. We eventually got to Pilsen and waited there. We could have gone in, but the Russians were making claim to Pilsen, to Prague, and we were not allowed to go any further. By this time, the occupation demarcation zones were in effect. But about 2 days after we got to Pilsen, as a token, we were allowed to go into Prague, where we got a tremendous welcome. But having gone in, we were forced to go out the way we'd come in. Even members of the Czech Brigade who were with us and whose home was Prague were not allowed to stay. So we already had an inkling of what post-war relations were going to be.